My mother had a few catchphrases that she would repeat over and over and over when I was growing up. Maxims of wisdom that we were wise to obey. "Hate is a very powerful word," was the first. "You can't be bored. We are not bored in this family," was the second. "If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all." But the maxim that I think I heard most growing up was the one that was usually found on a poster in any one of my elementary school classrooms. The poster's corners always seemed to be pierced by thumbtacks multiple times, for this was wisdom that you should take with you even if you change classrooms. The maxim read, "Treat others the way you wish to be treated." Which is a tall order for a 7-year-old with a 5-year-old as a sister. But if there was anyone in my family who always obeyed this elementary school commandment, it would have been Tessa. Tessa was our dog. Our loving, over-enthusiastic suck of a black lab. I loved Tessa. She was a constant companion, always trying to squeeze as much attention as she could out of us. I remember playing the piano and she would come over, nestling my arm off the keyboard onto her head. It's the reason I'm here, not over there. And sometimes when she looked up at me with her dark eyes and loving expression, I would lean down and give her a small kiss on the head. And if my mother happened to be in the vicinity when that small peck occurred, I would hear that stern motherly voice ring out, "Don't kiss the dog." I don't remember how old I was. I was maybe 8 or 9, but one time I shot back with that word that parents, I assume, dread hearing, "Why?" "Because she doesn't understand what it means," my mother replied. Looking down at her, I remembered all those summer days we spent in British Columbia at Lake Lillian. Us kids would hesitantly wade into the water, and Tessa would pace nervously on the shoreline. It was as if she could hypnotize us back from the danger that, of course, was waiting for us. We clearly didn't know of what lurked below. And as soon as we would got more than maybe 5 meters from the shore, it was as if we broke an invisible barrier. And she would race into the water, snorting misty water out of her nose as she barreled towards us. Sidling up to us, her face would push against our bare shoulders, trying to herd us back to shore, back to safety, back to where she could protect us. How, if she got us to shore, she would lick our hands and our feet in joy. So looking down at that moment, that why ringing out in the room, I thought of all those moments and so many more. And I thought about how dogs showed their love, how they understood love. And so, in full view of my mother, I leaned down, extending my tongue and licked her hairy head. My mom's face contorted. And Tessa just sat there as I tried to get the hair out of my mouth. I didn't know it at the time, but I had just lived through an evolution about my thinking about ethics. I had taken the golden rule of poster famed and turned it platinum. I had tried and probably failed to treat another the way they wished to be treated. I was sitting in a cafe in downtown Ottawa, sipping coffee with my friend Caitlin, when she said this statement. "If my future boyfriend, however hypothetical he seems now, ever, and I do mean ever, gives me a diamond ring when he proposes to me, I will throw it in his face and break up with him on the spot." Those are fighting words. What you have to know about Caitlin, though, is she was just finishing up her undergraduate thesis on the attempts by the international community to combat blood diamonds. The key word there is attempts. With her emphatic comment, Caitlin was in fact saying, "If the person who wants to be my future partner doesn't know me well enough to know how I feel about diamonds, then they don't deserve to be my partner whatsoever. Her comment was illustrative of not only her current state of mind, but about a fundamental truth of human relationships, that we experience and express love and affection in different ways. Well, the intent behind this hypothetical diamond ring would be in the right place. Its impact would be, well, off the mark. I'm sure I am not alone in being able to look back to my life, seeing all the times other people were trying to express love towards me, and it, well, being received a little off the mark. And the reverse is true as well. This is why Gary Chapman, a Baptist pastor, created the concept of love languages, if you've heard of it. Now, love language is a way to express and experience love. And Chapman says that each of us has a primary way that we show love to another person. This is our kind of go-to way of showing affection. And Chapman explains that there are 5 love languages or categories to express love through. The first is through gifts. The second, quality time. The third, words of affirmation. The fourth, acts of service, like someone cleaning the kitchen. Thanks, Charles. And number 5, through physical touch. Now, I am a quality time and acts of service type person. So if you want to show affection for me, the best way is to spend some good old quality one-on-one time with me. I remember I had a partner whose love language was gifts. So at every turn, I would see a little stuffed animal or a box of chocolates with my name on it. And each time I would smile and say, thanks. For when I took the love language quiz to figure out which one of these was my go-to, gifts scored 0. No wonder he isn't around. So you can take the test online, but you can probably figure out what language is your primary one. If someone is to express affection or love for you, would you want them to do that in the form of some sort of physical or monetary gift? Would you want them to spend quality time with you? Would you want them to do acts of service, helping you do things? Would you want them to share words of affirmation or grant you physical touch? Well, although there hasn't been any scientific verification of this theory whatsoever, it has this common sense factor that has kept it on the New York Times bestseller list since 1995. But what I think is most important about what Chapman says is about the application of these love languages. For he says that people should not use the love languages that they like the most, but rather the love language that their loved one can receive or wants to receive. That people should not use the love language that they like the most, but rather the love language that their loved one can receive. Which means that love is not just a feeling, but a set of practices that we engage in every day. And part of what love looks like is the quest to meet and understand the other, to learn what love means to them. But wouldn't it be great if relationships were truly that simple, though? That the secret to meaningful, fulfilling, dynamic, and sustainable relationships was simply to learn your partner's love language and love them that way all the time. Done. No divorce, no strife, no child-induced stress, nothing. You pile on the gifts, and your sweetie will never resent your inability to pick up after yourself. That your drinking problem is just one word of affirmation away from being A-okay. In this series where we're talking about real relationships, I think we can take the wisdom of love languages, but also trouble it a little bit, because real life is not that easy. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But there is, of course, a problem of where we learn about relationships from. The problem I found is that most of the things I learned about relationships came from Disney movies. And what I learned from Disney movies is that the most difficult part of being in a relationship is getting into a relationship in the first place. If you think about it, most of the plots of Disney movies are some trials and tribulations in which two star-crossed lovers are trying to finally get together. There may be magical sorcerers or evil animals or some sort of external threat keeping them apart. But once they're together in that end zone of marriage and that kiss happens, everything is fine. I'm not ashamed to admit that I spent about 30 minutes yesterday Googling the plots of Cinderella 2 and Cinderella 3. Many of you probably didn't know that Cinderella 2 and Cinderella 3 even existed. I was hoping that in the sequels to Cinderella, that it would mostly be kind of videotaped sessions of them in couples counseling. I mean, they came from completely different backgrounds. One a prince, one a lowly servant. They had a very unorthodox courtship. Their family dynamics left a little to be desired. And so I was hoping for some acknowledgement of now that they're in their relationship happily after, that there was some work that they needed to do. Unfortunately, Cinderella 2 and Cinderella 3 offer none of this. My favorite was Cinderella 3, for the entire plot of Cinderella 3 is something magical happens, and we go back in time. Yeah. And the shoe, the slipper, got magically changed size, so one of her stepsisters was betrothed to the prince. And so Cinderella has to go through the entire process of courting her husband again to finally get to that happily ever after. Those stories bear little reality to the three long-term relationships that have checkered my adult life. For getting into those relationships was by far the easiest part of the operation. It was staying in them that turned out to be the hardest part. What I learned there most profoundly is that sometimes love isn't and shouldn't be enough to keep a relationship together, which isn't exactly a great Disney sideline, is it? Paradoxically, I think the biggest gifts of these models of the platinum rule, the do unto others as they wish to be treated, and the love language is a fundamental recognition that we are loving across a chasm of otherness. And ironically, I think its biggest drawbacks is in promising that we will ever close that gap between us. In seminary, I spent a year teaching Our Whole Lives, which is our sexuality education program for junior high students. After church on Sunday, we would gather in the church basement and we would go through our lesson plans with the 8 or 9 8th graders that would gather there. Now, during the whole time, I feel like I made eye contact with each of them maybe 5 or 6 times. As we were talking about relationships, about consent, about sexual activity, about how to keep safe, how to put a condom on a banana, all those important skills, there was an awkwardness, a stiltedness of our relationships. Which makes sense. But one evening, we decided that we were going to go as a group together and take in a baseball game at Fenway Park, my first baseball game. So I was waiting down there for the group to arrive, and I was completely shocked, because who got out of the subway and greeted me in the night air was as if they were different people than who I met in that classroom on Sunday mornings. They were bubbly. They were curious. They were funny and sarcastic. They were engaged. They were really cool to get to know. One of the things I realized, and one of the things that was running through my head that whole night, was this question: who are these kids? And what did you do with my socially awkward junior high kids? Where did they go? I like these ones a little bit better, though. And that was a limitation that I brought on myself. For I fell into this trap that we sometimes do in our relationships, where we assume a constancy of who another person is across contexts. Here's a moment of like pastor disclosure. One of the things that is sometimes most jarring for me is when I see all of you out in the community. I'm like, oh, you're not always like in the committee meeting. Sometimes I see you out in the rest of your lives and it's a bit of a shock, and I'm like, oh, you're like that too. Which is my own inadequacies for my imagination of who you might be. And I quickly need to readjust my mental model of who you are to now account for this new part of your existence. Looking back, I can see how many of my past relationships stumble on this reality. My mental creation of who my partner was totalized them, boxed them in an effort to help me comprehend, understand, or feel some sort of stability in the relationship. The differences between us, which were not huge but were as real as any, were altogether terrifying to me because they put me in touch with the fundamental reality of being in a relationship of consequence, which is that I was hitching my life up to another person over which I had little to no control over their actions. And yet they were someone I had to rely on. And to deal with this fear, some of the times I tried to minimize that gap of otherness, bringing myself a little closer to who they were or who they wanted me to be, or tried to force them to come and be a little bit more like how I wanted them to be. But of course there is a violence in this, a violence to ourselves and to the other people, for it has the impact of imposing our will on who another person needs to be, who we want them to be, on them, totalizing them, constricting them, reducing them to one part, or maybe even one fictive element of who they are, which creates a pathetic affection that is rooted in a conditional or ultimately a love for a stagnant being that never truly existed. For the immensities of who we are as evolving beings is such that we don't even touch our full potential in our lives. That there is an infinity that is contained within each of us, a possibility that is boundless, a potential that we can't even comprehend. And if our relationships of depth, be they with partners or with family or with friends, are the place that constricts who we can be in our infinite being, if they are asking us to be, to not bring a part of ourselves to the surface, for we would break the mold of who they needed us to be in that moment or in that relationship, we find that our relationships are characterized by a violence of control of our potential. For real relationships to thrive, we need to abide by the evangelical Christian junior high dance rule, which is that you need to leave a little room for the Holy Spirit. That paradoxically, relationships that embrace the holy otherness of the other person are in fact the deepest of relationships we can be in. In 1917, philosopher of religion Rudolf Otto tried to construct the first rational study of the holy, or more aptly, human's experience of the holy. Otto concluded that our experience of the holy, that numinous, that unknowable reality that undergirded and underlying in all things, was mysterious. Which is a bit of like, duh. That unknowable thing that we can't know is mysterious. Great. But what he found as he studied cultures around the world about how they experienced this mystery was that two fundamental emotions were brought up as we experienced this unknowingness of the holy. That this mystery of the otherness of the world and other people is at once terrifying, but also fascinating. Terrifying and fascinating. And there is something apt to apply that experience of the holy, of that which we cannot understand, to our relationships, our real relationships, that which the relationships that allow a potential and a mystery of the other person. Because within the experience of a real relationship, I find there is a desire, this fascination, this drive to always want to know more about the other person, to be curious endlessly about the bounds of their existence, about who they are in this moment, who they will be, what is going on in their soul of their being. There is an inexhaustible curiosity about the object of our love. But at the same time, as we start to be fascinated by how much we don't know, how much we can't control, how infinitely possible these other people are, there is a good dose of terror thrown in as we realize that. Because we realize that we can't comprehend, control, or understand it. And yet, we hitch our lives to each other because we need each other. Mayra Rivera Rivera, a Latina theologian, reflects on this and calls us to an ethical paradigm of touch. She says that grasping for control of another serves only to totalize them, freezing their boundless potential to surprise us, their endless depth. Instead, we are invited to consider touch as the medium for love's transformation. And she doesn't mean physical touch, necessarily. She simply means instead of trying to grasp, to understand the other person, to hold and try to get a handle on them, in touch, we simply extend ourselves out to the other person until we make contact. In touch, we encounter the otherness with curiosity, not control. We are trying to not to encapsulate who they are completely in a mold, but simply, in this moment, invite a sensation of connection and knowingness into our lives. That love may be as simple and as hard as the repeated impulse to reach across the chasm of our otherness for the off chance we may briefly touch the soul of another for but a moment. And in doing so, be changed beyond belief. We meet in the space between us, Reverend Amy Carroll Webb writes, stillness, music, heard or unheard, the apparent void teeming with the you and the I that briefly touch in this one sacred living moment. This is where we are confronted with the very non-Disney realities of our human relationships, of real relationships. For real relationships are painfully hard at times, are punctuated with periods of deep ambivalence, never fully end our feelings of isolation, are fueled by a love much more powerful, constant, but less identifiable than the emotional rush that usually precipitates that first "I love you." That real relationships may not withstand even the most patient application of the platinum rule, but that real relationships that allow for possibilities to be boundless can transform us beyond recognition. Anne Merrow Lingden continues, a good relationship has a pattern like a dance, and is built on some of the same rules. The partners do not need to hold on tightly because they move confidently in the same pattern, intricate, but gay and swift and free, like a country dance of Mozart's. To touch heavily would be to arrest the pattern and freeze the movement, to check the endlessly changing beauty of its unfolding. There is no place here for the possessive clutch, the heavy hand, only the barest touching in passing. Now arm in arm, now face to face, now back to back, it doesn't matter which, because they know they are partners moving to the same rhythm, creating a pattern together and being invisibly nourished by it. May all our relationships be of curiosity and touch and not control. May we dance together this dance of our beings. May we be good to each other. Amen, and blessed be.